Chris, a number of questions here. For starters, a lot of people are reacting to the fact that you've laid out many of the problems facing us. You've certainly addressed it partly in tonight's talk, but a number of people are wondering about how to fight back. One person writes, a significant limitation of the left in the United States is that we're fragmented and mostly ineffective. Someone else, Carlos, writes, I'm appalled at the lack of information and organization of the American people. Questions, what do you propose as the best strategies to, number one, spread the word as to progressive ideas and analysis? And number two, how should people organize? Should they start a progressive challenge within the Democratic Party, or should they start an independent progressive challenge with the danger of splitting the Democratic vote?
I had lunch last week in New York with Father Daniel Berrigan, who will turn 90 in a few days. I saw him because I brought in our newest child, 3 months old daughter, and he baptized her and held her in his arms and talked about Selma and a life of commitment. And as Berrigan says, quoting his brother Phil, if voting was that effective, it'd be illegal. All of the true correctives to American democracy never achieved formal power, ever. The Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, they understood that, as Karl Popper wrote, the question is not how do you get good people to rule, that's the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, as Popper points out, are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is, how do you make the elite frightened of you? The last liberal president we had in this country was Richard Nixon, because we had movements that scared the crap out of them. And so we got OSHA and the Mine and Safety Act, Clean Water Act. It's not our job to take power. We must serve the principles of truth and justice, just as those who strive after power seek privilege and power. And the closer or the more we compromise with those whose goal is privilege and power, the more we diminish the capacity for truth and justice. The most powerful figure in the United States, at least until April of 1968, was Dr. Martin Luther King, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And we have been ruthlessly stripped of the capacity to make the needs and rights, especially of our poor, of working men and women, heard. Our media has been dominated, controlled by roughly a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, which didn't pay any taxes again this year, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, and shut out the voices of those who are suffering in this permanent underclass that we have created. And it's incumbent upon us who care about change to recognize that the rage and anger of our underclass is a legitimate rage and begin to express that rage as our own, because if we do not, it will be co-opted by these proto-fascist movements, such as the Tea Party and others, who will channel that anger and hatred, as totalitarian systems do, to scapegoats, to Muslims, to gays, to undocumented workers. They speak in the language of violence, they celebrate the gun culture, and it is incumbent upon those of us who care about our civil society to carry out acts of civil disobedience, because we are the last thin line of defense between that civil society and its destruction.
Well, riffing off of that theme, one questioner wants to know if you can direct us to activism that's taking on the corporations that manufacture weapons and sell them to countries around the world.
There's always something happening. I was just in New York, in Union Square, where we occupied Bank of America, which hasn't paid taxes for the last 3 years, although they've consumed $45 billion in taxpayer subsidies. And I think that we have to get over the preoccupation with numbers. I've been protesting outside of the White House with Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War, and these protests have in some way to become ends in and of themselves. When we protested in December, it was very heavy snowfall in Lafayette Park, and at the end of the rally, a great blues musician, Watermelon Slim, got up and played taps on his harmonica. Several veterans folded the flag of a young man who had been killed a week or two before in Afghanistan. Everyone was silent. Many of us have spent far too long in the midst of war and carry that trauma with us. There were veterans, often in their uniform, bearing tremendous emotional and physical scars. Someone beat a drum, no one spoke. And we marched in single file to the fence of the White House, and I'll be honest with you, many of us were crying. And we stood on the fence until 131 of us were arrested. And when the Washington, D.C. police put the plastic cuffs on us on our hands behind our back, it turned out that many of them had spent time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and as they walked us over to the vans to take us to the holding tank and the cell, they would say, "Keep doing what you're doing, because these wars stink." That's my church, and those are the people I worship with.
Well, our next question is a very interesting one about a lesser-known philosopher who essentially wrote the handbook on nonviolent direct action for a new generation of activists. This questioner asks, would you speak to the hopeful work of Gene Sharp and his influence on the nonviolent revolutions that have happened, although are incomplete, in Tunisia, in Egypt, and beyond?
Yeah, Gene Sharp is great, and I'm a huge admirer of Gene Sharp. I understand the poison of violence. I also understand how human beings can be pushed so far that they face a choice between extinction, as of course Native Americans did, and the employment of violence in a desperate act of self-preservation. I was in Sarajevo during the war, and it was very clear to those of us who were in the besieged city that if the Serbs broke through the barricades around the city, we had trench systems around Sarajevo, if they broke through those barricades, a third of the city, as happened in the Drina Valley, would be murdered, and the other two-thirds would be driven into displacement or refugee camps. But once you employ violence, it is always tragic. And that is why, of course, the criminal class and the gangsters organized the initial defenses of the city. And when they weren't shooting at Serbs, they were raiding the apartments of ethnic Serbs who would remain behind, looting them and often executing them. So there are moments. I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years. That's another example. Series of peaceful protests. Salvadoran Treasury police opened fire with machine guns on protesters, gave birth to a rebel movement, and I think civil disobedience for those of us who care about nonviolence becomes almost urgent at this point, because we are seeing the backlash against the power structures being expressed and articulated by a movement that celebrates violence. And if we don't succeed in building an effective resistance around core moral values, then the resistance will be expressed through a lunatic fringe of our political establishment.
Well, Chris, you have a bit of a fan club here. One person says, why don't you start an organization? You'd have many instant members. Someone else writes very simply, why are you being allowed to do this? I think the pat answer to that is because over 60 years, our community has brought together KPFA Radio. We've created this institution, which allows us to bring in dissenting voices like Chris Hedges, and thank you to everyone who supported that. But thanks. And in the spirit of that question, though, you were at the New York Times for many years. Was it 2 decades?
15 years.
15 years. How did you go from that establishment paper of record to this other world that you occupy now, truthdig.com? How did you make that transition, and how has that affected your ability to reach people?
Well, it was pretty easy. They asked me to go. I gave a commencement address. I was very outspoken against the whole argument to invade Iraq, a country I know very well. The Middle East is a region I know very well. The instrument of war I know very well. And was, you know, consciously committed career suicide. But it all, the final sort of culmination was a commencement address I gave in Rockford, Illinois at Rockford College in May of 2003, in which I denounced the war, and I had my microphone cut twice and was booed and jeered. It's all on YouTube. And at one point, the crowd got up and began singing God Bless America. My wife's an actor, and Michael Moore watched the YouTube and called me up and said, no, I think you're the really great actor in the family, just to be able to keep giving a commencement address. And at the end, two young men climbed up on the podium to try and push me aside. So I'm trying to give my talk while campus security is trying to push these guys back down into their seats. And they decide to escort me off the podium before the awarding of diplomas. They don't want the students to come in contact with me. And I had an academic robe, and I said, but my jacket, it's in the president's office. They said, we'll mail you your jacket. And they drove me to my hotel and watched as I packed my bag and put me on a bus to Chicago. And the next day, the Rockford Star ran a headline that said, Rockford College graduation speaker disrupts commencement. And of course, Fox and, you know, all the trash talk shows got a hold of the home movie footage and began running it in loops. And so they forced the Times to respond, and the Times called me in because we were gilled and issued me a formal written reprimand for impugning the impartiality of the New York Times. And that's the process by which you give an employee a formal written warning, and then the next time the employee violates that warning, you have grounds to fire them. So I knew at that moment that I had a choice. I could pay fealty to my career, but to do so would be to betray my dad. And I couldn't do that. And I quit. And when I walked out of that building, I realized or articulated for the first time that the greatest gift my father had given me was freedom.
Well, here's a question on religion, and before I ask it, I should point out that you graduated from the Harvard Seminary and infamously debated Christopher Hitchens right here in Berkeley. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago.
That's not an experience I'd wish on anyone in this room.
But what factors, the questioner asks, what factors do you think contribute to a person cultivating a universal, humane version of their faith tradition versus a narrow, dogmatic, and punitive version that dignifies violence as supposedly divine will? And they ask, Why did Osama bin Laden, for example, identify with the destructive path instead of following Rumi, for example? Well, I think we could probably throw in some other characters in recent world history who've used religion to justify violence, too.
H. Richard Niebuhr wrote, religion's a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. I wrote a book after I debated. I'll tell you this story because the only time I've ever been able to rip off a publisher. I was so angry. I debated Sam Harris at UCLA, and then I came here to Berkeley and debated Hitchens. And I'd never paid attention to these people. Most people would consider me an atheist. When the London Review of Books reviewed my book, they called me a non-believer. There's no Christian denomination that would consider me a Christian. And yet, I have also seen with figures like Berrigan, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, William Sloan Coffin, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, who's based in Berkeley, the greatness of religion and that capacity to transform. Art can do it. Religion is hardly the only vehicle by which it can be done. But I've seen it happen through what I would consider the authentically religious. And so I found most disturbing among the new atheists the way they had replicated the chauvinism of the Christian right through the language of scientific rationalism, that we justify, and it's why their political agenda completely fits. They all defend the wars in the Middle East, the use of torture. Sam Harris, three-quarters of the way through his book, The End of Faith, says that we may have to consider dropping a nuclear weapon on the Middle East, given what these people believe. And that's the language of Christian fascism. And I just spent 2 years writing about it. After I debated Hitchens, I called my agent and said, okay, I don't care how much money you get. You know, I don't care if you get any money. I'm going to write a book, attacking these new atheists for replicating the same kind of fundamentalist disease that I just spent 2 years reporting on in the Christian right. And so she calls up Simon and Schuster, who they're in their inimical wisdom thinks atheism, religion, oh, that's a moneymaker, without realizing that any committed Christian or, you know, Orthodox or Christian who read the book would hate everything I said. And so they call back and offered, I really thought they'd offer something which, for if you live off your writing, is fairly marginal, $5,000 or $10,000, and they offered quite a large sum, which I took, of course. Although they never made the money back. And called my wife up and said, "We're going to spend the summer in Capri." And so we went to Capri with Simon and Schuster's money, and that's where I wrote the book.
Well, here's a very Berkeley question for you. Was the counterculture movement of the 1960s a missed opportunity to prevent what has happened over the course of the last 30 years?
I'm very critical of the new left of the 60s because it divorced itself from labor. And that there are many factors of that are not always the fault of the new left. Unions were taken over by troglodytes like Lane Kirkland and George Meany, who would pass CIO resolutions in support of the war in Indochina and defending Nixon and denouncing the protesters. But I think we have to look back towards pre-World War I, when we had radical movements, Randolph Bourne, Jane Addams, Big Bill Haywood, Upton, all these figures who had built an alliance with a radicalized working class. And that split, and my book, Death of the Liberal Class, spends a long time talking about why I think that happened. But that split was absolutely deadly to protect the interests of working men and women, and created a kind of schism and distrust between, hesitate to say there are any radicals left, but there was a day when the message that was delivered by a Noam Chomsky, the same kind of message that was delivered by Eugene Debs, was instantly grasped by a politicized working class. And I think that we have to move back in that direction. And so without, you know, going into immense detail, and I think the other thing is that because I come out of the religious left, there's a belief, you know, as Berrigan says, that you carry out the good, but you don't know where the good goes. It's not our job to worry about it. Faith or trust is the belief that it goes somewhere, but we have to begin to define the successful life, not so much in what we produce or what we affect, but in what we do. And I think that whether you're religious or not is irrelevant. But I think that that point, which is certainly understood by Camus, who was not religious, but also understood by the radical Catholic worker Berrigan movement, is one we have to begin to ingest.
Well, I was just handed this question. Perhaps it's a bit of a follow-up. Do you think you have divided the world into the good guys and the bad? Do you think that mobs in the streets can be depended upon? Are union leaders all for the workers? And are all courageous acts of defiance against the system to be praised?
Well, I think all acts of defiance that affirm life in the face of destructive forces of power are not only to be praised, but what we should strive to emulate. I've seen what those acts can do. I covered the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. I spent every night in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel. And when I was in Prague in those weeks, as the communist government was being toppled, there were posters on every street of a Charles University student who in 1968, as the Soviets occupied his city, went to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire and died. Now, when that happened, it was a non-event. It wasn't reported in any of the state-controlled media. The funeral procession that was carried out by university students was broken up by police. When his grave became a shrine, his remains were dug up and cremated, given to his mother, and she was told she couldn't bury them in a cemetery. And yet, 3 weeks after Havel became president, he renamed Red Army Square in this boy's name, and 10,000 people were there. I was in Wenceslas Square when the most famous singer in Czechoslovakia, who had sung an anthem of defiance in 68, and who, after the communists regained control, had been blacklisted, not only blacklisted, but all of her recording stock had been physically destroyed. She was reduced to working as a laborer in a factory. And I was there that night when she walked out on the balcony and began singing that anthem. And I was with a group of university students, and they knew every single word, and they sang it with her, and the tears were running down their cheeks. Never underestimate even that solitary act of defiance. And that's why it scares the power elite so much. It ripples outward. It reminds people who, however passive they may appear, what they should be doing, what they should be affirming. In my first book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, I tell the story of a Muslim farmer, Fazıl Fadıç. I heard the story from a Serb couple, Drago and Rosa Sorak, who I interviewed and who, for most of the war, had thrown their lot in with the Muslim-led government in the safe area of Garajda, completely surrounded by Serbs, until, because of the paranoia and violence and food shortages, the Muslim police came and took their son, Zoran, away. He was disappeared, killed. And a few weeks after his disappearance, Zoran's wife gave birth to a little girl. She couldn't nurse the child, because of the lack of food and the shelling. And they were feeding the baby weak cups of tea, and it was dying. And on the 10th morning, before dawn, there was a knock on their door, and when they opened it, an illiterate Muslim farmer in a pair of rubber boots named Fazl Fadich handed them a liter of milk. He had three great brown and white milk cows that he could only milk at night because of the sniper fire. Milk in Garajda at that time was worth its weight in gold. And he came back the next morning, and the morning after that, and the morning after that, and the morning after that, until the Muslim neighbors found out what was happening. And as he would ascend the stairs, they would insult him and spit at him and tell him to let the Chetnik children die and give the milk to Muslim babies. I heard that story from the Soroks. And when they told it to me, they said, but it is our duty to tell you that not all Muslims are bad. And so I went into Garajda to find Fadich. His cows had been slaughtered for the meat. His apartment block had been reduced to rubble. He was sleeping in the basement with other men, and they were picking worm-eaten apples from an abandoned orchard and selling them on the sidewalk. And when I told him I'd seen the Soroks, he said, and the baby, how is she? In that act of defiance lay an ocean of hope. He kept alive within that community another way of being, human empathy, dignity, respect for life. That little girl may grow up and never meet him, and yet she will know that she is alive because of the kindness of a Muslim farmer. Acts of defiance, true acts of defiance that affirm what we must affirm, radiate outwards and tear at the structures of hate and death that appear to us so unassailable and monolithic. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Thank you.